about the Irish Republic. So far as my limited knowledge of the time goes, I think she is accurate as to detail, although she would be the first to confess that she had little understanding of the social forces working below the surface. When eventually a great convention of all those different groups was held, it appears to have been called together as a Sinn Féin Ardèche, but it became in fact a mobilisation of all those advanced nationalist forces seeking an effective organisational form. By that time the prisoners of the Rising had been released, and by their presence they strengthened the elements within that convention that were hostile to Griffith and favoured a Republican stand. Many of the volunteers resented the term Sinn Féin that had been pinned onto them by the British pressmen, and they wanted a complete break with Griffith, who was still unwilling to campaign for an independent republic. De Valera, who had recently been elected in Clare on a programme which, though somewhat vaguely stated, was popularly understood to be Republican, but who himself approved of Griffith's economic ideas, found a formula. This is it. Sinn Féin aims at securing the international recognition of Ireland as an independent republic. Having achieved that status, the Irish people may, by referendum, freely choose their own form of government. It would be hard to find fault with that formula for what is in it, unless we notice what is not in it. The form that a struggle takes is bound to have a determining effect on its outcome, and that formula gave no indication whatever of any kind of popular struggle that must necessarily lead to a break with the Empire. It left, as we may suppose it was meant to do, a door wide open for the return of Griffithism as a dominating influence, and Griffith seized his opportunity. He threw in his lot with the general voice of the convention and became vice president of the new Sinn Féin party. After the declaration of independence by Dáil Éireann in 1919, he became Minister for Home Affairs, and for the greater part of the pre-truce portion of the War for Independence, he was acting President of the Republic. When Owen McNeill was proposed as a member of the executive body of the newly constituted Sinn Féin party, he too was opposed by many of the volunteers who had not forgotten the countermanding order that had broken the back of the Rising, and again De Valera found a formula. McNeill, he said, might have made an error in judgment, but I am convinced, he added, that John McNeill did not act otherwise than as a good Irishman. That undoubtedly was true, but good Irishmen, unfortunately, do not always have the same political objectives. And both Owen McNeill and Arthur Gilbert took their places in the government of a republic in which they did not believe. They used the republic as a stepping stone to home rule in which they did believe. Heather O'Donnell, in his book There Will Be Another Day, has discussed this portion of our history with greater penetration than anything that I have seen. Describing the re-entry of Griffith into a position of leadership, he wrote, "The country saw high drama in the incident at a Republican delegate meeting in the Mansion House, when Father O'Flanagan, reporting on a backstage conference with Griffith, announced that Griffith has thrown in his lot with us. The delegates got to their feet and cheered, but nobody noticed that Connolly's chair was left vacant, that the place Connolly purchased for the organised labour movement in the leadership of the independence movement was being denied or reneged. It is easy to explain the failure of the new IRB leaders to bring into the reorganised independence movement the pro-Connolly attitude of Pearce and Kent and Plunkett. Their attitude had been one of sympathy, not of agitational involvement, and sympathy leaves no heirs. It is not so easy to explain the failure of Connolly's successors in the labour movement to claim a place in the newly formed leadership. It ought to be remembered, though, that the position of Connolly and the Citizen Army in Liberty Hall had not been altogether so unchallenged as we have since been encouraged to believe. It was pretty precarious at times. Anyway, whatever the reasons may have been, there was no revolt among the Labour leaders when De Valera issued his edict, Labour must wait. I have tried to show how consistently hostile Griffith had been to the Larkin-Connolly movement before the Rising. I have tried to show, too, that those IRB leaders who, with Connolly, were responsible for the proclamation of the Republic, leant towards Connolly's politics and not towards Griffith's. When Connolly was co-opted onto the military council and appointed to command the Republican forces in the Dublin area, no one had suggested that in the interests of national unity, Connolly should stand aside and allow Griffith to lead. No one suggested then that Labour must wait. But now, at the reorganisation, Griffith, who had been persuaded with difficulty to take his stand with the Republicans, was installed in a position of leadership while Labour was told to wait, and Labour waited. That was the great failure of our generation. I don't think it is too much to say that it was the determining factor in causing the collapse of the independence movement. As a result of the general election of 1918, the Republic was established by popular vote. It was immediately attacked by the forces of the Crown, and as the war developed in its defence, and the war that developed in its defence was fought in a political atmosphere dominated not by Connolly's mind, but by Griffith's mind. Griffith, at that time, was acting President of the Republic. De Valera was in America. Ernie O'Malley has described the attitude of the IRA volunteers as being, generally speaking, vaguely sympathetic towards the cause of Labour, and that, I think, was about the size of it. Whatever gestures were made towards Labour by the government of the Republic were kept well within the bounds of the social system then prevailing. The right of the people of Ireland to the ownership of Ireland, claimed by the 1916 proclamation and itself an echo from the Citizen Army Constitution, was not made to mean the right of the people of Ireland to the possession of Ireland. Landlords were protected by Republican courts both in the slums of Dublin and in the countryside. In certain areas where landless men tried to move in on the ranches and the main lands, the Irish Republican Army was used to prevent them from doing so. A pamphlet called Constructive Work of Dáil Éireann, issued in 1921 by Austin Stack, then Minister for Home Affairs, describes that development. While the Irish Republican Army were establishing their authority as a national police, I'm quoting here, a grave danger threatened the foundations of the Republic. This was the recrudescence in an acute form of an agrarian agitation for the breaking up of the great grazing ranches into tillage holdings for landless men and uneconomic smallholders. There was a moment when it seemed that nothing could prevent wholesale expropriation. But this crisis was surmounted thanks to a patriotic public opinion and the civic sense of justice expressed through the arbitration courts and enforced by the Republican police. At the end of the quote. Another pamphlet called Construction Work of Dáil Éireann No. 2 tells how, and I quote, terrified landlords flocked up to Dublin to beseech their protection, to beseech protection from the Dáil. And it goes on to tell how they got it. A number of men had taken over some ranch land and had defied the order of the court to vacate it. Now I quote, one night, about a fortnight from the issue of the judgment, the captain of the local company of the IRA descended upon them with a squad of his men, sons of very poor farmers like themselves, arrested four of them and brought them off to that very effective Republican prison, an unknown destination, unquote. Fintan Lawlor, who had been so eulogized by Pierce, the best thing Pierce ever wrote, I think, was his what he wrote about Fintan Lawlor in Pierce's last pamphlet, The Sovereign People. He thoroughly approved of Fintan Lawlor and Fintan Lawlor's attitude in the 48 Rising. But to Griffith, Fintan Lawlor was a man who had tried to throw the agrarian struggle across the nation's road to freedom. With Griffith as acting President of the Republic, it is not to be wondered at that Fintan Lawlor's teaching played no part in the conduct of that war. It is not difficult to imagine what Fintan Lawlor, or Connolly for that matter, would have had to say of a Ministry for Home Affairs that described such police work as constructive work of Dáil Éireann, safeguarding the foundations of the Republic. But Connolly's chair was left vacant. The business interests that have dominated the Treaty State since its foundation did not only seize power after the defeat of 1922, they had been building their position within the Republican movement ever since the general election of 1918 had made it obvious that Redmond's Home Rule Party was finished as a protecting force. It was in the crisis of the treaty that they showed their teeth. The courage of the guerrilla fighters, backed by the loyalty of the people, forced a parley. But they had built no pattern of life around them that could make the people understand what was happening when their struggle to undo the conquest became, to their leaders, a wrangle over symbols of subjection. Treaty versus document number two. When the treaty settlement came to be debated in Dáil Éireann, there were many speeches made against it that were admirable for their courage and for their devotion to the ideal of Irish independence. But so far as I know, there was only one that showed much understanding of the realities behind that settlement. Madame Markievicz, speaking as a disciple of James Connolly, pointed out that English imperialism was working by a change of names. It is the capitalist interests in England and Ireland, she said, that are pushing this treaty to block the march of the working people in England and Ireland. That policy has since become familiar to the world under the name of neocolonialism. Arthur Griffith's part in the treaty settlement was logical and consistent. He had always supported the capitalist interests, even to the extent in 1911 of putting aside temporarily his Irish rebel attitude and calling upon the British forces to break a Larkin Connolly strike. Now, in the sharper crisis of 1922, he again called upon the British forces, and this time, when the borrowed guns were roaring around the forecourts, there was no protest from Mr. Cosgrave. There had been that much clarification on one side of the barricade. On the other side, there had been no such clarification. The Larkin Connolly leadership was gone. The IRB, beheaded of its pro-Connolly leaders, threw its disciplinary influence behind Griffith and against the Republic. The Labour leaders, well-meaning obviously, but without vision, with their sights drastically lowered from Connolly's objective, blundered into support for Griffith's state, and a politically leaderless IRA fought a rearguard action in defence of the Republic until it could fight no longer. That war, though it put an end to the independent Republic, was so hard fought that it forced Griffith's state to rely for support on the wealthy pro-British trading interests to an extent greater than Griffith had dreamed of and greater than he would have liked. And so it fell to the Fianna Fáil party when it came to power in that state to try to put Griffith's theories of industrial development into practice. The partition of the country and the tendency of capitalist industry everywhere to consolidate into bigger and stronger cartels have militated against the successful working out of Griffith theories, and the pressure of the Anglo-American power bloc, the leading political expression of that tendency to consolidate, has forced the 26 counties government to abandon its attempt to maintain an independent position in domestic or in foreign affairs, and to work back towards a closer integration with the British economy and with the political and military requirements of the Anglo-American alliance. A member of the Six Counties Parliament recently described this change of policy as politically the greatest thing in Ireland since the Act of Union. It emphasises the logic of the unionist approach to Irish politics and underlines our knowledge that these islands have a common interest in the world today. It creates a trading area such as we had in 1921. So we are back pretty much where we began. O'Neill is at last on talking terms with Lamass. It is not my purpose to attempt to assess the merits of the various groups that are trying now to find some way to resist this surrender, but only to suggest that as the squeezing out of the Labour leadership from the vanguard of the independence movement was of such importance in ensuring its defeat, so it would appear to me that if there is to be any future for the Irish people as a free people, it must depend upon a return by organised labour to the politics of Connolly. The power of the moneyed interests is the great pressure power on one side, and it can only be effectively met by the power of organised labour.
There are some very good people in the Labour movement, generally speaking and broadly speaking. But I think that side by side with the fight inside the Labour movement for recapturing some of the perspective that Connolly had must be the fight outside the Labour movement by all the people who are opposed at the present time to what can be termed as the great sellout of the national independence of the country. Now, this is my second occasion here at the series of meetings organised by the Woodtone Society. The first one I attended was the one that was the other night on the question of the Irish language, 1916. And I think coming from the discussion on that subject, there was projected the idea, not merely the idea, but the actual need, imperative need, of all those who are concerned about the language and concerned about other issues beside the language, whether it's democratic rights against the use of police batons, or whether it's the question of free trade, or whether it's the question of economic development. The question that emerged from that was the need for some sort of unity between all the forces that are opposed. And I think that if such a unity can be gathered between all such forces at the present time, I think this will have a tremendous external effect on the Labour movement, and I think will help to bring about the recapturing of the Connolly idea and the Connolly objective and perspective in the Labour movement. Tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Interested. I have an awful mess here of notes as to questions, and if any one in which anybody is very much interested is missed out, maybe the chairman will allow it to be put very briefly just to remind me, because there were lots of questions that I'd like to answer, and unfortunately I can't listen and write legible notes at the same time, and the notes I have aren't very legible. But there's one thing especially that was mentioned there about Madame Markievicz's attitude when she was Minister for Labour in that Republican government that was making the volunteers support the landlords against the people breaking their actions. Now, somebody was a bit worried that I was blaming the volunteers for that. Of course I wasn't. I was a volunteer at that time and I was doing what I was told. And I didn't happen to come in touch with any of that kind of activity because it wasn't in my area. But not one bit of blame in my mind against any volunteer who carried out his orders. The only other thing he could do would be mutiny. Somebody suggested that it was a danger that if those agrarian activities had been allowed to continue, that would have weakened the Republican effort. Well, now, the direct contrary is, to my mind, the case. And that was not only apparent in that particular movement. As long ago as the 48 Rising, young Irelanders fell down on their job. And at a time when the country was ripe for revolt, they wasted all of that revolutionary material because they would not allow the starving people in those terrible years of 47 and 48, and the people were starving, they would not allow that to be made part of the Young Irelanders' agitation. I'm not slamming at people, I'm not tarring Redmond or anybody else. People have different views of these things and different points of view, and if they act according to their points of view, we can respect them. But we should try to worry out what the points of view are that make things happen as they do happen. Now, Fintan Lawlor was the one great voice at the time of the Young Irelanders who tried very hard to get the Young Ireland leaders to base their Republican uprising on the struggle of those starving people to continue to live, to continue to exist. And nobody of the Young Ireland leaders except John Mitchell paid any heed to him. John Mitchell did. John Mitchell took up that point of view, but it was too late then to make that a basis for the rising. And they tried to have a rising in 48, and it was the greatest fiasco of any rising in Ireland, although the country was ripe for revolt. Well, now, I maintain that although the thing wasn't at all so sharp as that, there was no famine in the time of the 1919 war, but if we had encouraged the landless people and the small economic holders to break up the big landlords' ranches, it would not have weakened the Republican movement. It would have made a foundation for it. And then when Arthur Griffith's treaty came along, people would have seen that was an attempt to take away the land from them and give it back to the landlords. And that's why I say that even if it was only a matter of tactics, that it would have been a good tactic to take possession of the landlords' big estates and not to treat them badly. Mind you, I know one area in Ireland where a thing was done that I like to think of, and that was on the Marquess of Cunningham's estates in Donegal. That was one area where some of the volunteer leaders encouraged the people to go in on the Marquess of Cunningham's estates and to divide them up and till them. And the people who were doing that, there was a committee of people in Dunloe who were organising that taking over of those estates. And they wrote to the Marquess of Cunningham and told him that as a landlord, he had no rights, but that as a man, he had rights the same as other people, and that if he cared to come before that committee, when they were distributing the land that to be tilled instead of used as a ranch, that they would see that he got enough of a holding of the land to enable him to keep his family in decency the same as other people. Now that was if that had been done generally, that wasn't even allowed to be done in Donegal, because the government of the Republic at the time, Richard Mulcahy being chief of staff, sent a staff officer up to Donegal to choke off the volunteer leaders there who were encouraging that to be done, and it was stopped. But if that had been done now, instead of defending the landlords, think of the difference that there would have been when the truce came and when people came back with that treaty, which was basically a treaty to give all sorts of appearances of self-government here without any change of ownership. The proclamation of 1916 said the ownership of Ireland is claimed by the Irish people, and Pearse emphasised the fact that it was not to be a theoretical ownership only, but the possession of the land of Ireland by the Irish people. That was Pearse, the way he put it. Well, if that had been done, we would have built a foundation for the Republic, and the people would have maintained it, because they would have understood then what was happening when the treaty came along. That is one point that was raised, and I think that you could hardly shake me on that.
Yeah.
But there were other points raised then, and one of those was about tarring Redmond. Well, no, I'm not tarring Redmond. Redmond had his own point of view, as other people did. My goodness, I grew up among people who were unionists, nearly all of them. Some of them were Orange men. And they were as good people as any other people in their wishes for things. They had different points of view about what was good for this country. That's the difference. And that's what we have to try to understand. Not whether people are good people or bad people, but what their point of view is leading to and is likely to lead to. And this question then was brought up about what people might have done after the Republic had been established if Connolly's views had led to its establishment. Now, I can't tell you what might have happened because I'm not St. Colum Kill. I'd have this faith in the ordinary people of Ireland that if we had succeeded in winning our independence, and if the dogs had been drawn off so that we could have organised the country, the ordinary people of Ireland are sane, sensible kind of people, and they would not have started massacring each other, I think. I think that it's the interference from outside that causes these troubles. The 1922 fighting is sometimes referred to as a civil war. Now, it wasn't a civil war. It was a continuation of the defence of the Republic. The issue... the issue in that war was the same as the issue had been before the truce. And if that had been successful, it was the interference there of the British who ordered the bombardment of the forecourts that started that. The Irish people, if they had been left in possession of the country, they're just ordinary, decent people who would have managed better than that. I'm wandering a bit, I know, because of some of these... Well, anyway, Madame Markievicz was Minister for Land, for Labour in that government, which acted in a way that I wish it hadn't acted. Madame Markievicz herself, when she spoke against the treaty, had expressed views that showed that she saw what was in behind that treaty, that it was the people who owned the country keeping hold of the ownership of the wealth of it by giving over a flag. Griffith said he brought back the flag. Well, of course he did. And they painted the pillar boxes green and all sorts of things like that. But she was just an ordinary human being like the rest of us. And I'd have to confess that although she made that good speech and made that good point, she was not always consistent. She, so far as I know, maybe she fought that corner to some extent within the Republican cabinet, but I've no evidence that she did. I'm sorry now that when she was alive I didn't ask her those things.